The show today comes with some trigger warnings, tax triggers, fact triggers, and a little bit of stone ground whole wheat. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 28th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There were actual on-the-record votes on the Senate tax bill today. 12 of them from Republican members of the Senate Budget Committee voting aye, 11 from Democrats voting nay. Consideration by the full Senate could start tomorrow, but that is kind of burying the lead here because before the voting started, there was a whole lot of politicking going on, a big part of which was how to appease the deficit hawks, people like Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee and a handful of others who object to the $1.5 trillion these tax cuts would add to the national debt over the next decade. The $1.5 trillion in debt is already in the bill, so the hawks have lost that fight on the merits. But Corker still voted yes in committee today after something called a tax trigger was added to the bill. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath explains exactly what that is and how it might work.
Imagine a new college graduate who says, hey, mom and dad, I need to borrow $1 trillion. But listen, I just got my degree. I'm about to earn all kinds of money, so don't worry. I'll totally pay you back. That's basically what the Republican leadership is promising with these tax cuts.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Maya McGinnis is president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
The tax reform bill is actually predicated on the belief that the economy is going to grow enough that it could offset $1 trillion of borrowing.
Unfortunately,
none of the credible models that are out there actually find the tax bill would grow the economy by that much.
And that makes your congressional deficit hawks nervous. So this talk of adding a tax trigger, where tax increases to offset all that debt would be triggered if the growth that's been promised doesn't materialize, a sort of break glass in case of low growth option. This idea of tax triggers gets thrown out a lot, says Bill Gale of the Brookings Institution.
But they're really hard to design to ensure that they don't do more damage than they do help.
For example, there's this question of
which taxes would go up? Are we talking about undoing some of the rate cuts? Are we talking about undoing the repeal of some of the deductions?
Any choice would hurt some folks and help others, with ripple effects throughout the economy. But the irony, Gale says, is that if a recession hits and triggers the trigger, that's the worst time to be raising taxes. Martin Sullivan of Tax Analysts is lukewarm on the concept, but given the enormous debt the nation is facing, he says,
although normally triggers would be a very bad idea, in this circumstance, we should take a serious look at them.
And take a serious look at this quickly, since Republicans want this bill delivered by the end of the year. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
There is, as of today, just one person in charge of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. A federal judge said so this afternoon. Mick Mulvaney, the president's choice, gets the job. But we are going to back up for a minute to yesterday and something Mulvaney said to CFPB staffers. Elections have consequences, he said. And President Trump wants him, that is Mulvaney, to prevent the CFPB, and this is a quote, from trampling on capitalism and choking off financial services. Is that really what's been happening? Marketplace's Amy Scott is on that one.
In a press conference yesterday, Mulvaney said the CFPB will be a different bureau under President Trump.
We both share the belief that this particular bureau under the previous administration had gone too far over towards strangling access to capital.
And that, he said, can keep lower and middle class people from getting credit and starting their own businesses. Tom Quadman is with the Center for Capital Markets Competitiveness at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Many startups and small businesses actually use consumer financial products such as mortgages, home equity lines of credit, credit cards to actually get their business up and running.
And Quadman says not enough of those businesses are getting up and running. But is access to capital really strangled? Christian DeRitas follows consumer credit and the economy at Moody's Analytics.
It's hard to make that argument based on what we're seeing in terms of consumer credit and what we're seeing in the small business market as well.
Household debt just hit a new high of close to $13 trillion, according to the New York Fed. Mortgage, credit card, auto, and student loan debt are all up.
Certainly there are portions of the market where credit might be more limited, but overall, credit seems to be flowing pretty well.
In fact, the Federal Reserve is comfortable gradually raising interest rates, which can have the effect of slowing down borrowing. Stanford finance professor Anat Admati says the CFPB's role is to crack down on fraud and abuse.
But there's no preventing honest lending to people and businesses.
And if it's harder to get payday loans and subprime mortgages, maybe that's not such a bad thing. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Only in the Washington, D.C. of 2017 would confirmation hearings for the guy who's basically going to manage the American economy for the next 4 years be news item number three. But here, somehow, we find ourselves. You don't want to call Jay Powell's hearing today to replace Janet Yellen as Fed chair a non-event, but it kind of was. Not too many hard questions, no real objections. Banking regulation and interest rate hikes did come up, but the smart money is still on Powell getting confirmed. The smart money on Wall Street today was to the upside. All you need is a tax cut bill getting through a committee vote, yo. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rossello, said this week that from now on, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, is going to have to approve all hurricane recovery-related spending on the island. The decision comes as just 56% of electricity generation has been restored since Hurricane Maria hit. That was 10 weeks ago. And that lagging recovery is part of the reason that 170,000 people have left Puerto Rico for Florida, a number that experts are guessing is going to jump in the next 6 months. Federal, state, and local agencies are struggling to meet the needs of those new arrivals, the biggest challenge being where everybody is going to live. Marketplace's Renata Sego reports.
Jonathan Gonzalez sits in the lobby of Orlando International Airport, his 7-year-old daughter asleep at his feet. His 5-year-old is stretched out in a row of chairs. His toddler is in his arms. Their belongings, a suitcase, a large sack, and some book bags are piled up in a luggage cart.
This is everything we have. Yeah, everything.
Gonzalez left Puerto Rico about a year ago, long before Hurricane Maria. He went to Memphis and worked odd jobs. When Maria hit, his wife and kids rode out the storm in the coastal Puerto Rican town of Fajardo. They went weeks without power and water.
So I put all my money that I had to bring them back to United States.
But Gonzalez didn't have space for everyone. He'd been sharing a place with his friend. So when his family arrived, they all checked into a motel. They could only afford it for a week. They decided their best bet was to pay a driver for a ride to the nearest official Hurricane Maria Relief Center.
We ride for 12 hours all the way to here to Florida to try to get help.
The Relief Center? It's at the Orlando airport, curtained off in a far-flung corner.
My wife is inside there, trying to see if she can get food stamps, vouchers. And she's trying to get approved for the hotel and try to see if he can get a job for a couple weeks.
The family has camped out 3 days, figuring out their next step. Gonzalez would prefer to start a new life somewhere cheaper than Florida, but they need to earn money here before they can do that and find a place to stay in the meantime. About 170,000 people have evacuated Puerto Rico for Florida, according to state officials. They're living in all kinds of places, some with family members, some in hotel rooms paid by FEMA, and others sleeping overnight in cars in airports, like Gonzalez.
This is really not like anything we've seen before.
Viviana Janer is commissioner for Osceola County, home to the largest concentration of Puerto Ricans in Florida. Before Maria hit, she says about 1,000 Puerto Rican families were arriving each month, fleeing chronic unemployment on the island. And before Maria hit, affordable housing was already an issue for Central Florida.
Our number one industry is tourism, service driven. And so the wages have not quite kept up with the cost of, you know, either renting or buying a home. Conversations have to take place as to what can be done.
She says last year, 11,000 people applied for just 200 Section 8 subsidized housing vouchers. For many Maria evacuees, housing help from FEMA is the only immediate fix. So far, the agency has placed families in more than 1,500 hotel rooms as part of its transitional shelter program, with thousands more expected to apply. FEMA can't solve the long-term housing crisis, but Florida's Affordable Housing Trust Fund can, says Congressman Darren Soto. He points to more than $300 million earmarked for the cause.
It could be to encourage builders to build a bunch of apartments where you can have rent between $800 to $1,200 a month, which seems to be about what people can afford.
For years, Florida's dipped into its Affordable Housing Trust Fund to pay for other things. But Soto says the influx of new arrivals means those dollars should now be spent as originally intended. In Orlando, I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Today in You Learn Something New Every Day in This Job, something called shelter belts. Long rows of trees stretching for miles across the Great Plains, a relic of the Dust Bowl days back in the 1930s, and a term with which I was heretofore unfamiliar. Key to farming back then, but the economic realities of modern agriculture have put those shelter belts at risk. Carson Vaughn wrote about them for the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kai.
Tell me what these shelter belt things are. As I said, I've never heard this term before.
Sure. Shelter belts are basically synonymous with a windbreak or a hedgerow. Basically, they're a line of trees that help prevent blowing dust and dirt on fields out here in the Great Plains.
And here we are now, 80 whatever it is years later. Those shelter belts are being cut down basically because the economics of farming have changed.
Yeah, that's right. Essentially, whether you have a good year for commodities or a bad year for commodities, farmers are finding justification to rip them out. So on a good year, like in 2012, when we had $8 a bushel corn, we wanted to plant every acre we possibly could. So a lot of farmers tore out the trees to plant a little bit more corn or a little bit more soybeans. You have a bad year and a farmer looks at it and says, I need every dime I can muster. And so he tears out the trees again. Kind of works both ways. We're stuck in sort of a strange conundrum.
And these shelter belts, I mean, they are known and recognized. I mean, in your piece, there's a picture of a historical marker next to one. I mean, these are actual tangible things.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, when FDR in July 1934 signed the executive order for the Forest Service to get moving on this project, it was a huge deal. Ultimately, they planted 220 million trees wow. on 18,000 miles of windbreaks. It was at that point the biggest technical job the Forest Service had ever undertaken. So this was no small matter, and it really it went a long way in helping farmers crawl back from the effects of the Dust Bowl.
One of the things that happens when you run a farm today is it's really capital intensive, right? It's not just getting the crops in the ground and getting, $8 a bushel for corn. It's you have to buy a combine for 100 and whatever it is, $1,000, probably more than that. I don't know. I mean, it's capital intensive, right?
Yeah, that's right. And that's a big, that's another factor here on why we're seeing these trees go away. You put in so much money purchasing these, massive combines that are very, very expensive. Pieces of machinery are just much bigger than they used to be back in the day. And because of that, we need to make room for those machines to run. And that often requires, again, tearing out these old trees that once served a purpose and still do.
You talk to the farmers and they say what about having to rip out these trees? Does it kill them? Or are they like, I got to make money, man?
Well, I mean, it totally depends. I certainly don't want to generalize. Some farmers still have that conservation ethic, but a lot of them are simply looking at the bottom dollar and they're saying, even if I like these trees personally or have a sentimental attachment to it, they're not making me the money that, a few more acres of corn or soybeans would be.
Carson Vaughn, writing about shelter belts out in Omaha, Nebraska. Carson, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Kai.
Before we do today's numbers, here's a tip for you. For as little as $5 a month, please consider signing up as a Marketplace investor. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. You might not know that we're a nonprofit news organization, one that's on a mission to increase economic intelligence all across this country. It's important work that we're already doing, and with your help, we'll do more of it and reach more people as well. You can donate today at marketplace.org. And thanks. Coming up.
I probably was a little crazy to launch a wheat-centered business in the middle of the biggest gluten-hating period.
Yeah, gluten schmooten. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 1% today, 255 points, 23,836 at the close for the blue chips. NASDAQ picked up 0.4%, 33.6912. S&P 500 up 0.9%, 25 points, 26.27 there. Stolen self-driving technology and disappearing messages sound like a movie? It is, in fact, the trial between Alphabet's Waymo and Uber Technologies that was delayed by a judge today. Alphabet, also parent company of Google, down 0.8% today. Elsewhere in tech, Intel up about 0.5%. Dell Technologies rose 0.7%. Microsoft's cloud is getting bigger. It's partnering with SAP SE. That's a German business software vendor to manage big corporate data. Really, though, another effort to challenge Amazon's dominance in the cloud space. Microsoft up 1.2% today. Amazon.com down about 0.1%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.32%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The corporate news of this Tuesday comes with barbecue sauce and blue cheese dressing on the side, maybe some celery if you're so inclined. Buffalo Wild Wings announced this morning it's being bought by Arby's, or more accurately, Roark Capital, which controls Arby's and a bunch of other food brands, Cinnabon and Jimmy John's among them. The deal comes in at about $2.5 billion, just the latest item in the consolidation trend afoot between fast food and fast casual. Marketplace's Andy Euler takes a look at what this buyout might mean for your wing fix.
Chicken wings are so popular right now that wholesale prices rose almost 20% this year. And you know what input cost does to the bottom line. Buffalo Wild Wings reported a more than 60% drop in profit in the second quarter. Bonnie Riggs is restaurant industry analyst at the NPD Group. She says just a few years ago, chicken producers couldn't give wings away.
And now they're the most expensive part of the chicken, and they wish they had 6 or 8 wings per chicken because they are so popular.
That was not in the business plan for a restaurant chain based on frying up cheap cuts, putting some sauce on them, and selling them at a premium. Kevin Burke is managing director at Trinity Capital. He says to make Buffalo Wild Wings profitable again, the new ownership should innovate because right now the model's full of waste.
If you're really buying wings and you don't want the whole bird, you're going to wind up paying a high price. And I think that's just something that Buffalo Wild Wings is going to have to figure out.
Bonnie Riggs with the NPD Group says what restaurants are trying to do is promote a different, lower-cost product as a result, the boneless wing. Buffalo Wild Wings is doing Boneless Tuesdays, but it isn't a wing at all. It's other parts of the chicken compressed together to look like wings. Riggs even has a report on this called The Chicken Wing Dilemma.
Will consumers accept a boneless wing, or will they accept the high price of the bone-in wing?
And if any given franchise doesn't sell enough of either, she says they can expect the new investors to start closing locations that underperform. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Hidden in a slightly industrial-looking strip mall smack in the middle of Pasadena, California, is a flour mill. It's a small place, actually. Artisanal is probably a good description. Grist and Toll is the name of the company. Nan Kohler is the owner and miller.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm well. How are you?
I'm
Welcome.
Kai. Nice to see you.
Nice to meet you.
Back in the back is the mill itself, Austrian-made, mostly of wood. Picture a big funnel up at the top, feeding down into the two millstones doing the actual grinding of the wheat.
So now I'm going to turn the mill on.
All right.
So you can't see it, but you can probably feel that vibration here of the runner.
Oh, yeah, stone. A little bit. Yep. Oh, and here it comes. Look at that. Little flour stuff coming out.
Now we're going to feed some grain, and I'm going to start to move the stones a little closer. A little bit at a time.
There are a dozen or more plastic tubs nearby filled with various kinds of wheat, milled to various degrees of coarseness. Not a single one of them, I should tell you, the generic bleached white flour you get at the supermarket.
As long as there's been wheat and milling and baking, there's been a desire to have white refined flour. White flour, white bread has symbolized so much in our history.
Yeah.
Class, wealth, status, politics, religion, we are very tied to white bread and white refined flour.
There's an entrepreneurship question to ask here. How long have you been up and running now?
It'll be 4 years this holiday season.
You bootstrapped it yourself on credit cards, or how did you wind up getting started?
No, I had a small amount of money to invest, and then absolutely credit card debt.
Yeah.
And then a small business association loan. I've learned a lot now. I would do things very differently if I was starting all over again today.
Are you profitable?
Yes. I think the critical thing that I have been able to show, because I literally am the only business model like this, as far as I know, in the United States. There are definitely independent stone mills popping up in other regions. I know of five or six of them, but that's it. But I'm the only one that went for it, dropped itself in the middle of a very urban, big city.
I mean, you can hear the traffic going by.
Yeah. And with direct access to all customers, both chefs and professional bakers, you know, so the wholesale level, but our local home baking community, which has been incredibly supportive. I absolutely had obstacles in the beginning with getting up and running and getting all of my permits in line, and it's the home bakers that paid my rent and kept the lights on.
So there's a lot that goes on with wheat nowadays, right?
Yes.
Gluten-free is one of them. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. How big an issue is that for you as a business person?
I probably was a little crazy to launch a wheat-centered business in the middle of the biggest gluten-hating period in our lives.
She says not at all bitterly.
But the truth of the matter is milling absolutely matters. I have so many customers who come in weekly who say, I had cut wheat out of my life. I was no longer eating bread, and you have changed everything for me. And now I don't have the same issues that I had before. Celiac disease, obviously something very different. Yeah. They can't even walk into this place.
All right, cut me a slice of bread, please.
This is hard white wheat called Prairie Gold, blended with an heirloom wheat called Oland, which is originally from Denmark.
Oh, no, that's good bread. Wow. God, that's really good. Holy cow. With quality and with all of these things that you value in this bread, it ain't cheap.
It's not cheap. And definitely important parts of the conversation have to do with that transparency and what I would call real wheat pricing. We have tremendous opportunity in California. We grow beautiful wheat. Because of our amazing climate, we can do fall plantings. We can also do spring plantings. So we have much more flexibility with when we can put the grain in the ground. That's great for farmers and how they manage their rotations. We also have some of the most expensive land in all of the United States. That's why we grow beautiful wheat, but it's been dropping the amounts overall because it's much more profitable for the farmers to put more expensive vegetables, higher cash value crops on that same land.
Right.
When wheat milling left the city centers, everything that supported that also left. So the other bigger part of the conversation with pricing and why I'm an expensive part of this equation, but I would argue a very necessary part of this equation, is even for farmers who plant 5 to 10 acres for me, having the right seed drills, having the right combines that can come and harvest, all of those got junked. And so now they're piecing together that, the smaller scale seed cleaning facilities that handled wheat, gone. Their minimum batch sizes are pretty huge. So it is really a big thing to try and put all of these things in place. And at the beginning, it's never inexpensive.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This was lovely.
Thanks for the conversation.
I appreciate the bread. It was good bread, I'll tell you that. Okay, this final note on the way out today, which doesn't really matter, except somehow it really does matter. Google is out with an update to its Android operating system in which it has corrected its egregious hamburger emoji mistake.
For those not up on it, last month the entire internet basically realized that Google's hamburger had the cheese below the beef patty. That is directly on top of the bottom bun, which is clearly A, wrong, and B, insane. Cheese goes on top of the patty, to which place Google's new hamburger emoji has rightly restored it. We had it all today, man. Hamburgers and chicken wings and good bread. A little tax policy, too. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 1% today, 255 points. NASDAQ up 0.4%, about 33 points. S&P 500 gained 0.9%, 25 points. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is our executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.